Mr. White is going to join us at about 7 o'clock. He had to be a little late. And just to review what the project is, we're compiling a history of the black community in Detroit over a 50-year period from 1918 to 1967. The idea is to really create a picture of the black community over that period, because it's lacking in typical history books, other histories of Detroit, and also to show the progress that not so famous people have made in the community. And so we've had groups on different topics and are continuing through the fall to have group discussions. And basically what I want is just your reminiscences, your own memories and thoughts about this subject, your own involvement, the involvement of others that you know. And you know, you don't have to be knowledgeable about anything except your own experiences. And hopefully, when this manuscript is compiled, it will be published. Wayne University Press is interested in publishing it. And so that it will all be narratives of the people that we interview, and very, very little other than the people's interviews. So I think I'm going to begin by just asking a sort of a provocative question. These are kind of loose sessions, so you can say anything you want to say. And the question in is, when did the notion of civil rights begin in Detroit? Anybody? Mr. Goodman, would you like? When did the idea that you had the right, you know, when did the idea come about that people had the right, had rights?
Well, when the,
come about?
When the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment were added to the Constitution after the Civil War, I guess everybody was at that time aware, general view, that everybody had supposed to have equal rights, particularly the black people found in slavery were to be free. But the general notion didn't really affect the activity of the communities, especially following Reconstruction. And I think, from my reading at least, it's true in the North as well as in the South, although I think the extent of it was varied between the two regions. The modern notion of civil rights and the way we're thinking about it now, for me as an individual, I don't know what, I can't make any general observation on that, occurred in the late 1920s and during the Depression period following that, gradually developed. That's a very general statement.
What do you recall as a beginning? Any incident, any particular incident that you recall?
Well, I remember there was a Sweet trial highlighted the issue in Detroit, and while I was not an active political figure or very knowledgeable, it certainly affected me in that same way it must have affected others. As far as personally concerned, I began to understand it during the Depression. I saw people who were unemployed, and people who were denied a home. Frank Murphy was mayor, provided for the first time in the United States a place where people could sleep. Men in one place, women in another. That, to me, represented a kind of a civil right that I became aware of. Then the action from that point began to accelerate personally.
Dr. Carter?
Well, I guess I was born in 1940, so I can remember, though, my great-grandparents who came here from Georgia and Tennessee and other parts of the South, came here primarily seeking economic freedom. My great-grandfather and great-grandmother in the late teens joined the Second Baptist Church, which at that time was under the leadership of Robert L. Bradby, who was an outstanding minister here in the city of Detroit. He was the minister of the oldest African-American church in the city of Detroit, in the state of Michigan, founded in 1836. Well, the story goes that Reverend Bradby, for instance, could pick up the phone and would call Henry Ford I, and was able to secure jobs for his membership. And the word, of course, got out into the community and certainly beyond the boundaries of the city of Detroit. Well, I can remember my great-grandfather coming to church along with men of that era in the 1940s and late 40s. And of course, he died in 1954. His name was Appleton Lawrence. But they would wear their badges to church. And I believe that with the coming of the unions, and there was a new, hope for economic freedom, along with the opportunity for black and whites to interact. Now, not everything was smooth, because I can remember the stories of deep racial segregation. The fact that blacks had a certain day to go to the certain places of entertainment, like the Greystone, mm-hmm. and, right. And some other places, and then my mother came to Detroit in 1925, joined her grandparents from Memphis, Tennessee, and of course she grew up in the Detroit public schools, and I can remember from talking with her, and also talking with my godmother, Irma Henderson, who both of them went to Eastern High School, Old Eastern High School in the city of Detroit. And I remember them indicating to me the racial discrimination that occurred even in the school system during, for instance, the 1930s when they attended high school. But I believe that the civil rights movement obviously started here in the city of Detroit with the great economic move, the great migration to the north, to the northern cities, and in particular the city of Detroit. The auto factories were paying, I guess, $5 a day at some point, and allowed many African Americans to upgrade their standard of living. I didn't understand all of that as a child growing up in what is now Joe Muir's back parking lot, because that was the street that we lived on, Waterloo, which was the same area that a lot of African Americans lived at that time. Coleman Young's father was a tailor. Charlie Diggs' father, the congressman Charles Diggs' mm-hmm. father, was the undertaker, the funeral director, and there were others. Joe Lewis was my great-grandmother's paper boy. So there was a very tight neighborhood around that area mm-hmm. of the city. But I think the beginning of any awareness of the civil rights movement in modern times, of course there were racial riots, and I read about those things going back to the early 1820s. But the Great Migration, of course, started in the early teens, the early part of the century, mm-hmm. and the Great Push started in the 1920s.
In the 1920s?
Well, I think that was the time that there was the development of a significant African-American population here in the city of Detroit with, of course, the the great incentive was the jobs mm-hmm. offered by the auto mm-hmm. industry. My father came very late in that migration period. I think he came from a place called Milledgeville, Georgia in 1937, and by accident got on at the Chrysler Corporation and remained there for 41 years. But the interesting part about all of this is that the migration patterns here in the city of Detroit forged, I believe, one of the most significant middle-class African-American populations in the mm-hmm. entire country, based on what the unions provided during that time in terms of equal pay. Before that, the opportunity to participate economically through Henry Ford and through the churches, mm-hmm. as demonstrated by the Second Baptist Church mm-hmm. in terms of its contribution. But the civil rights movement or awareness had to start with the economic development of African Americans in this city. Once one could secure some degree of economic security, then one could turn your sights to justice. And there was certainly very little of that outside of certain sectors here in the city. And most of this comes by way of my own great-grandparents who lived during that era and who lived until my great-grandmother died in 1970. So I was constantly asking her questions mm-hmm. about that era. But certainly there are other examples, and with the coming of the political awareness, mm-hmm. election of William Patrick to the city mm-hmm. council. I remember as a kid I participated in passing out flyers for William Patrick. And before that, Reverend Charles Hill of Hartford mm-hmm. Church was one of the first African Americans to run for the city council in modern times. And I remember Irma Henderson and a number of other people, Coleman Young and others, when they were quite young, participating in that campaign. So I was there, and was just a kid of 12 or 14 at the time, but was real interested. But I want to point out that William Patrick was not the first African American elected mm-hmm. to the Detroit City Council, most people think. Yeah. But there was another in the, I believe, in the early mm-hmm. part of the century, mm-hmm. while they still had the ward system. But the economic development came first. It was the Great Migration. Then the civil rights movement started with political awareness, starting in the late 40s and moving into the early 50s.
Okay, we'll do some early, continue with some early memories, and then we'll move into the other times. Ms. Hall, would you like to share any experiences or memories that you recall?
We came to Detroit in 1927. Mm-hmm. Not looking for work. We had a flood and we lost a house. And my mother always said the children in the Bible. And my uncle was a chemist at the state with the highway department in Michigan. So told my mother to come home and
So did you go to Sacred Heart?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, my mother didn't like that because in the South. Mm-hmm.
Did you try to go to the local church?
Oh yes, my mother. They told them, we live St. Joseph's.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was two blocks.
And did you go in? Did you try going
in? My mother went and said, no, you can't, you don't speak Polish or something.
Oh, that's a good one.
This is when my mother turned her religion around.
Mm-hmm.
She got mad at the church, but, you know, we went to Sacred Heart, and, you know, they said, mm-hmm. But we live a kind of conservative life, even when we're in the South. And moving here, the main thing my parents were concerned about is education. And that's what, that was the most mm-hmm. important thing that they thought we could get in Detroit than we could get down South,
mm-hmm.
which was I graduated from Northeastern High School in 1933.
Mm-hmm.
But when you went to high school, you could take up a college course, a general course, a commercial course. And so I took a general course because they said, you won't go to college, so you won't take a college course.
Mm-hmm. What did you take in a general course?
Just about everything, chemistry, biology. I went to summer school. Well, there was no jobs. And
that was during the Depression, too.
Yes. I graduated in 1933. Mm-hmm. So I went to Eastern, to summer school. I went to Cass, to summer school. There was nothing to do. I mean, we were a little kind of close. We were not allowed to do a lot of things, mm-hmm. you know. So I went to summer school because other than that I wouldn't have that much to do.
Mm-hmm.
Sit on the porch and I didn't like that. But getting that type of when I finished high school, I took a PG course. I passed all the civil service examinations, the federal, the state, the city, the Board of Education. And when I showed up, I didn't get hired because they found out I was black. That made it very difficult. So I worked.
Did they tell you that?
Well, you know, we never got a reply
mm-hmm.
of why they turned you down. And my mother, you know, she's, you know, was wondering, you know, could I get 85 or 89? Mm-hmm. I'd sometimes take the test over, and once mm-hmm. one of the tests I got 92.
Mm.
But they were not hiring. Oh, but they would offer me a job to do some work like in the kitchen, like the Board of Education.
Mm-hmm.
You could work at the, you know, the cafeteria or something.
Mm-hmm.
But went to the Polish people had a store on Hastings Street where they sold milk. I was hired there to work. And good housekeeping. A man had a store on Mac. Well, I don't know if it was Claremont or someplace. And I worked for them, that type of work,
mm-hmm.
until the state hired me.
When was that?
In 1940.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for the, it was not that. It was in Holland Park. Miss Bledsoe was my supervisor. I mean, it was just
Okay.
Cloud and things.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for the state until 1949. And then the federal government had a war and they sent for me. I had been on their
mm-hmm.
list, and then they told me if I didn't take the job, they'd take my name off the list. And
go to Mr. Marks. What are your earliest recollections of the whole concept of civil rights?
Well, I was just, I've reminisced a little bit about this. It's so ridiculous, that I'm such a Johnny-come-lately. Even though all my professional life was spent in the, the governmental aspect of civil rights, as an employee for the first, it was called the Mayor's Interracial Committee, and later as a director of the Detroit Commission on Community Relations, which was the successor agency, and then finally I retired after 37 years with the successor agency, which was called the Human Rights Department of the City of Detroit. But my first recollections were almost not recollections at all. I mean, I remember growing up in Dearborn. My folks left a house at Woodward and Forest and bought a piece of land out in Dearborn and built a house. And I remember ethnicity. I knew I was an Italian. I knew that wasn't the best group to be in. We always had fights with the Scotch and the Irish and the English. And so the Italians and the Poles and the others would make common cause. I mean, if there was pairing off or ganging, you found the groups that you could be allied with. There obviously were, lots of strains, but it wasn't until until I got to college that I had any real knowledge about race and civil rights at all. My dad had been a coal miner and was very much an aggressive unionist, but he so I guess that's where my whatever social philosophy, if I have any, that's where that came from. He had come north to after they ran him out of the lines, so I got some appreciation of the kinds of struggles that people can engage in for their own welfare or benefit and that sort of thing. But it was really it really took service before I had any genuine contact with persons who were black. And when I look back at it now, I think how ridiculous it was. One of the more important assignments I had in the military, I got a break because I left an infantry division and went, a bunch of us were sent to school. And at that school, which was in Clinton, New York, we studied French and German language. I mean, we were all destined to become interpreters, after we graduated, be seated throughout the service, and then, go overseas and be in positions to be interpreters. In that unit were about, maybe there might have been 200. A good 50 of the soldiers in that unit were black. And that was the first time that I really had any living experience with blacks. We were completely segregated. We lived in dormitories, but on a segregated basis. And none of us, I didn't even cotton to it. I didn't even realize it. That it was just so neatly arranged and never anybody talked about it. Mm-hmm. And the experiences were very interesting because people had been assigned, soldiers had been assigned to this unit irrespective of their rank or their background. So you'd have we would sometimes have drill sergeants who were black leading this 200 men complement in military exercises and drills. Our classes were not segregated in any way. We were completely integrated. And some of the people, blacks and whites, some were native speaking Germans and French. Others were trained linguists. Some had taught in colleges and things like that. And as it happened, I came to the unit knowing only one language, which was Spanish, and they weren't teaching that there. I mean, it was really quite an interesting experience from that standpoint. But that was the first real contact I had with, on a living basis. I mean, we played poker together, we served together, we went to school together, went into town together.
What year was it?
That was 44. So I mean, I'm really that's really late in the spectrum of things to be getting into the subject of race. When I went overseas, I went over with an all-white unit. When we got overseas, about the time of the Battle of the Bulge, when things were very short, our unit was assisted by a black tank, segregated black tank battalion. And as it happened, in service there were lots of feelings about race. I mean, particularly because with a segregated army, which we had, blacks were usually in the quartermaster corps and in the back units. I mean, in support units, and most of the fellows who were assigned to infantry divisions, where life was at risk. Always felt that was pretty cushy back there, and so there was a lot of hostility of a racial sort. But in our unit, when this black tank battalion was assigned to us, they proved to be such courageous soldiers and did so many really heroic things in relationship to our men that the attitudes in our division changed almost completely. I was in a position to observe that because I was in a military police unit, and whenever we pulled duty, and when we would have to patrol towns and that sort of thing, when our soldiers, if they were black, when they got into trouble, if they were this particular tank unit, we didn't have any problems. We could solve the problems. Whereas, we'd have fights going on constantly between the American soldiers and the British soldiers. The Americans would call them limeys, and the British would fight back. And, you just have a big hullabaloo on your hands. I mean, but that was the genesis of my own. That was the basis on which I really got straight on the subject of race, subject of how you measure a human being. When we came back from service, we came back to the city that Mr. Carter has described. I mean, it was a thoroughly segregated city. You couldn't go to a hotel, major hotel downtown and have a cup of coffee with a black colleague. I mean, we couldn't. I couldn't. When I joined the staff of the Mayor's Interracial Committee, one of the first things we discovered is the fact that we had to take advantage of the Diggs Act, which theoretically guaranteed the right of people to eat in public places without discrimination. We discovered that we had to ourselves be forcing on that issue.
What year was that, the Diggs Act?
Well, I joined the staff of the commission, the Mayor's Interracial Committee, in July of 47.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said earlier, I served it as a director of research and information. I mean, I was both the publicist and the road research director for about 10 or 11 years. And then I got an opportunity to become the director of the successor agency for another 12 years or so. And then finally ran into trouble with one of the mayors, with Kavanaugh, and then I simply dropped back to my permanent civil service title, which was as assistant director, and stayed on until I retired. But I have had the advantage, I suppose, of being right at the intersecting point in this community of, between government and the community. So all the battles that were fought out, I was, you know, always astride the problem. I mean, the problem seemed to focus right on top of me. Because, I mean, for example, when we had the police crackdown on, as most of us knew, on black citizens, that infamous period at the end of Rudy Giuliani's mayoralty.
With the police harassment, you mean?
Yeah, well, where the police, I mean, the police were very upset about...
There was a limited period, because it seems...
It was a very specific period in which the policy of the city, the policy of the police department was to aggressively, they called it aggressively police, which meant that they stopped people on the streets, primarily blacks, who appeared not to be where they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And so inevitably, that meant that they were picking up judges and union officials and people, you know, that were in the community doing what they had a perfect right to do, legal right to do, but it got to be, you know, just an inflammatory period.
What years would you say that is?
Let's see, it had to be about 53.
Is that when the stress unit was?
No, the stress unit came later. Came quite a bit later, actually. This was, God, I can't remember. Is it 47? It must have been. Well, I know it was the end of Louis Mariani's.
Mm-hmm. So it was.
Just before Kavanaugh got elected. And so that would have to be about 50.
Early
60s.
About 60.
And the kids, I was a high school kid at the time, we knew them as the Big Four. And I don't know what the formal name was, but we certainly recognized them riding in these big cars with four police officers. Coming out with the rubber hoses and cracking us across the back.
Were there more than one Big Four?
Oh yes, yeah.
Every precinct had a Big Four. Oh, okay. Because I had, I spoke to a couple of businessmen today from the 12th Street area who talked about the Big Four.
Mm-hmm.
And so every precinct had a car, a big Lincoln, they said, with four men in it, plain clothes men in it.
And they would stop indiscriminately.
Yeah, right.
On street corners, boys would be walking from school or
kids.
You know,
I mean,
kids.
They would
yeah, we
kids.
Were. But at that time, I was 16 or 17. I was a student at Eastern High School in the 50s, from 54 until 58. I know, and that was the time of the reign of terror of the Big Four. We were frightened. While I was not personally involved in any altercations with the Big Four, I certainly knew of incidents that my friends encountered. So that was a real concern in the African American community. I think it probably led, based on a number of meetings that I attended, again, with my godmother, Irma Henderson, later became city council president, much later, decades later.
Mm-hmm.
It precipitated, I believe, the eventual election of Mayor Kavanaugh and paved the way, you know, for other events that occurred during the 60s. But there was a strong negative, very negative reaction to that kind of brutality, just utter brutality. I can remember as a kid, I was always interested. We lived again on Waterloo, which is now, as I said, the parking lot of Joe Mears. Mm-hmm. It must have been the year 1947 or 48. We moved in 48. There was a killing. A child was killed, stealing a loaf of bread. And this was, and I remember there was a great, huge meeting at a church called the Macedonia Baptist Church. And
this was by the police?
By the police. This was in the late 40s. I can't pinpoint the date, it's my memory, but I do recall just cars and just people coming. Macedonia Church was on St. Auburn, St. Auburn, Waterloo, J Street, Antietam area, which is all gone. It's a part of what we call Lafayette Park today. But
was his name Mosley?
Was that the Leon Mosley?
Leon Mosley.
Okay. I don't.
That was about 1947, 48.
Okay. And that was. Do you recall that? Were you, Mr. Carl Winter told me about that they had a parade. They had a
George Crockett and Elvin Davenport. He was not a judge. He was a prosecutor. Myself. Represented the family, mostly family. We had an inquist, which was at that time a legal procedure.
And was that?
And there was a citizens' jury that sat, and they recommended that the police, who shot Leon, I think he was 14-year-old, in the back as he was running away, they'd be prosecuted. And they did issue a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
But that. It ended up in a complete fiasco, which is not uncommon in those days.
Right. It didn't follow through?
No, what happened was that the policemen were charged with the crime, and at that time the defendant could waive a jury if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have no jury trial. And try to have a trial before a judge. And the police were able to make sure that the case was assigned to a judge who would be understanding of their point of view. And that was Judge Gordon. And when these defendants were tried in front of him, he ended up the case with a long statement in which he blessed the NAACP for having been guilty of conspiring with myself as an attorney, and Maury Sugar's law office was mentioned in his statement in which he found the defendants not guilty. And, and the defendants ultimately were the NAACP and myself. But that's the way justice was administered.
That's right.
It was not too uncommon.
That's right.
Can you, is that what happened, that he took a loaf of bread from a store? Had he taken a loaf of bread from the store, and was that why they shot him, or did they just presume that did that?
I don't remember whether he took a loaf of bread or not, but they claimed that he had engaged in some criminal activity. But all they actually saw was this fellow, young guy, running away.
Right.
Because the police were there, and quite likely that he knew that if they were to get him, they'd beat the hell out of him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They didn't do that. All they did was kill him. Those were the alternatives black people had in the community at that time with the police department.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in, Mr. Winter was telling me that they had, you know, when they had the funeral, that there were, were you involved in that?
Well, I went to the funeral.
And they were carrying banners and so on. Were you, can you tell us?
It was a political funeral.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about
that?
I
don't remember anything in particular except went there, and a crowd of people were there, and they had services, but beyond that, I can't give you any.
I think the newspaper boards would contain not a necessarily a proper point of view, but at least the information would be in the morgue that you could, if you really.
What was the year, do you think?
It had to be after National Avenue. Remember the National Avenue thing?
National what?
National Avenue, where that house, they moved into that house on National Avenue, and we had to organize not only to repair it and restore it, the fire we planned it. And we had to restore it, and we had to protect it around the clock. It's where I met Sophie Williams.
Go back and start the story.
Well, there was a black family moved into a house on National Avenue, and they organized a campaign to terror drive them out, and they actually partially destroyed the house, and we used building trades people and others to restore it and paint it and everything else, but we had to defend it around the clock. I can remember that quite vividly. It's also, you mentioned Carl Winters. He was one of the people that probably remembers better than anyone. I remember marching with him, and it was the first time I ever met Sophie Williams.
Mr. White, I think that we've left you out so far, so we'll give you a chance. We were just going around asking for people's earliest recollections of the whole idea of civil rights, and that people had a right to demand equality. What are your earliest memories of becoming aware of activities or that concept?
Fort Hunger March and subsequent efforts to organize workers. And it's where I encountered people that, convinced me that that which I literally suckled at my mother's breasts, namely that blacks were, you had to be kind, but not, they were less than whites and so forth. And to overcome, that kind of background. The trade union movement and the people I encountered in, most of whom were labeled, some were, but most of them were labeled communists, whether they were or not. And
trade union people were labeled communists?
Yes. I didn't know the difference between communism and rheumatism. I was still labeled, even though I was attending discussions with in the Catholic trade union circle that subsequently became the ACTU. But those were the people that had the greatest impact on me. I worked in a factory in General Motors where there were 12,000 workers, and that, to the best of my recollection, before the war, there were three blacks. Two of them worked on the baling machine that baled the cardboard and the metal, the scrap metal. And the other one that I remember worked in the garage of the executives washing the cars and maintaining them and so forth. Those are the only three in that number of people. And that was a plan too, primarily, well, I would, that primarily were women, but about 60-40 women and men. And this is before, you know, I was fired in 1929 for participating in a work stoppage that was encouraged by some of the people.
That was at Ford? Or at, sorry, at General Motors?
And I was fired again in 34. But all of these were before the union. And each one of these experiences, you know, you encountered people and you that altered your attitude towards a lot of questions. And this was not a, you know, it was a process of divesting myself of all of the racist ideology that I had been exposed to. And also anti-Semitism and anti-foreign war.
Mm-hmm.
And I often think of my father, who was a trade unionist, who said, once saw me when I was a kid and said, who's that girl you were with? I told him it was an Irish girl. You know. He said, well, what parish is she in? So why don't you find a nice Irish girl in your own parish? That's how provincial.
That's pretty tight, isn't it?
And, you know, but that was not uncommon. That was true of Italian and Polish and Hungarian and all of these ethnic. These were enclaves in this city that were pretty tight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and of course, Black Bottom was those blocks down in St. Antoine. And you would go there for on Saturday for cheap whiskey and entertainment, you know, and the blind pigs and that sort of thing, which was considered the the hep thing to do among the whites, which and many of them were clubs in which very few blacks were in, mostly whites were black entertainers. And
black ownership.
And black ownership. Yeah.
I can remember during the late 40s and up to probably through 1950, there were groups of people meeting around the city, integrated groups. And again, my reference point strictly with my parents and Irma Henderson, but I remember meeting, going with my parents as a child to her apartment on Canfield and Woodward. And at those meetings, I would sit and listen, and people like Mr. Mahoney, who was an insurance person who was very active in the community. I believe Coleman Young stopped by once or twice during that period of time. These were Saturday evenings, blacks and whites. There was a strong coalition at that time between black activists like Irma Henderson and others and Coleman Young and the Jewish community.
What year was that?
This was, my memory only goes back to about 47 or 48 and in the late 40s, because I was about 7 or 8 years old, but I remember going and sitting in on those meetings. And I can remember them talking about the lynchings in the South, and I remember Truman, I guess, took over the White House in 45, but I remember them sending telegrams to the president at Blair House, because they were renovating the White House at that time. I remember the word Blair House being said over and over again, and of course that impressed a 7 or 8, 9 year old at the time. But I also remember a convention, a national convention that they all participated in. They supported Henry Wallace, for instance, for president that year. 1948.
That was 48.
The Progressive Party. I know that Irma did, and I believe people like Coleman Young and others, and I know Sid Rosen was a very good friend, mm-hmm. was very active as a young man during that particular period of time. But I can also remember the rumors about our phones being tapped. And as we moved from the late 40s after that convention into, I guess, what was I later learned was the McCarthy era. I didn't know anything about that at that time, but I just remember discussions around phones being tapped. And the highlight of that period for me actually occurred in April of 1954 when I got a phone call. I was at home, and it was raining that day, and we lived on Holcomb and Mack. And Irma Henderson lived on French Road near Canfield. And she called me. She says, how would you like to celebrate your birthday today? And I said, well, this is a little early because my birthday was April the 27th. And this was somewhere around April the 14th or 15th. Mm-hmm. So there was a very special man at my house, and I'd like for you to come over and meet him. And I said, okay. And so it was raining. So I got on my bike, and I rode my mother was already over there, but I rode my bike from Holcomb and Mack to French Road in Canfield, and Irma Henderson met me at the door and introduced me to this very huge man with a very warm smile. It was Paul Robeson, who stayed with her during that particular period of time. There were many African-Americans and whites and others who wouldn't be caught in the same block with Paul Robeson because of his views on...
There were many African-Americans who wouldn't be?
There were some African-Americans and certainly many, many, many whites. Again, he was surrounded by this group cadre of people, of African-Americans and whites and others who worked with him and supported his cause. And I remember the roast beef dinner that Irma cooked that day, and it's the first time I'd ever seen anyone eat rare meat.
Or Paul Robeson?
Paul Robeson. I didn't. I said I want my well-done and crispy. But I was very, very impressed. We must have stayed over there for 4 or 5 hours that evening. And,
do you remember the conversation?
Well, he talked a lot about his life and singing, and I think he I don't remember if he told us a lot of stories, and I don't really remember a lot of the details. I just remember us sitting around in the living room, sitting at the table, eating, and doing a lot of laughing, and he was a very kind and gentle person, and there were a number of other kids over, black kids and white kids at the time, Irma Henderson's neat children, and there were some others, some of the friends of some of the children of some of her friends, and we just had a delightful time that evening. Later on, of course, I learned much, much more about that era and what was going on. But for me, that's a very, very important memory, that one evening with Paul Robeson, with my mother, and Irma Henderson.
I think Mr. Goodman...
Yeah, well, that period is one I mean, you would remember. Here are some pictures that might recall. By the way, in all this discussion among us, one person's name has not been mentioned, but who should be mentioned, Reverend Charles Hill.
Hill, yes.
Reverend Charles Hill.
Okay.
Reverend Charles Hill was a great leader in the black community in many different ways. And so few people remember his name. Important role he played in this area, more than just a few words to tell, but he should be remembered much more, and his life as assigned to it, others knew it, was very, very important to the development of civil rights in this community. But here are some pictures that we took during the Progressive Party campaign. One was in Reverend Hill's basement. You've been in
And Paul Robeson sang at Reverend Hill's church. Hartford Baptist
Yeah,
Church.
The co-pastor, a slight man, but I can't his name, I should never forget.
Yes, I remember him too. I don't remember his name, but I remember him very well. But Paul Robeson, those days, was not permitted in most places. He couldn't sing anymore as he used to in the Masonic Temple filled with 5,000 people. Nobody would have him. But he had come to the Hartford Avenue Baptist Church and Reverend Charles Hill. This was the house that Reverend Hill lived in, basement. And we had, after Paul sang in the church, come over to the house and we'd have a sort of a little party. And here's Reverend Hill on this picture. This is myself. This is Paul. This is, you recognize him?
Coleman Young.
And I know him, but I forget his name. My memory is bad. At the same period, this was another picture. This was in Reverend Hill's house that I see his son there. And there's a Paul, and here's a she was the candidate for Secretary of State on the Progressive Party, and I was the candidate for Attorney General. Roberta Barrow. Roberta Barrow. We went campaigning together all over the state. This is myself. I look a little different than I do now. It's Dean Robb. And that's his wife.
Barbara.
And here's another picture with Henry Wallace in it, and Roberta Barrow.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, these were all the members of the Progressive Party are running on the state ticket.
Mm.
Four of us.
I've never seen Henry Wallace.
How would you describe the Progressive Party?
I describe it. Well, it was a party that was developed when the Cold War began, in opposition to the Cold War and what it meant, and the different foreign policy in that sense. And it was organized on the basis of complete equality of black and white. And it took a strong, firm position on many of the domestic issues.
Foreign subsidies.
And so the people who were members of that party were somewhat ostracized.
Certainly became so. Mm-hmm. And Henry Wallace, who was the head of the party at that time, was vice president of the United States prior to that time.
Oh.
Represented a real split in the Democratic Party. You know, that was the genesis of it.
Strong Thurmond ran on the Dixiecrat ticket.
That's right.
Mr. Goodman, I know that you have to leave early.
Yeah, I'm going to have to leave right now.
Oh, you have to leave right now? I was just going to ask if you would, do you have 5 minutes?
No. Well, I'd like to join the common discussion. It's sort of fun talking about things, having others remind you of other things. What is it you want to ask me?
Well, I was just going to ask you about your own involvement directly in civil rights. I mean, by being a partner with George Crockett, how did that come about? And what did that lead you to in terms of civil rights activities? Maybe you can just answer that real quickly, and then I'll maybe meet with you privately.
Within a few minutes, George Crockett came to Detroit from Washington, where he was with the Department of Labor, the highest black employee in that department at that time. The whole government really had the highest position. Came here at the request of the UAW, R.J. Thomas was the president, asked him to form the FEPC department, Fair Employment Practices Committee, within the UAW. which he did in 1944. And he remained 45. At any rate, he then remained there for 3 years. He organized the department. And until he was forced out by Reuther in 1946, when he was elected, Reuther became president. And then he came over to our office, Moore Sugar's office, in which I was one of the members of the office. And we had sort of an interracial group, but most of the lawyers in the office who had been working for the UAW, locals and international, were leaving because our office was boycotted by the UAW. We couldn't get any business through them.
You were boycotted?
Our office was, yes, because our politics didn't agree with the politics at that time of the head of the union. So in 1950, however, we decided to form an interracial partnership of lawyers, first such interracial partnership that we knew about in this country. And that's how our partnership began. And the story outside of just the bare facts would take more than a few minutes. It's interesting, but
was Bob Miller also one of your
Bob came in 1962 or 63. But Claudia Markham was an associate member of our firm in 1959, I think she was, became a member of the firm, and other like members later on. But that story is, of course, an interesting one for anybody who's interested in civil rights, because we spent a good number of years just doing nothing else but handling civil rights cases. We didn't make much of a living, but it was a hell of an interesting period out there.
Well, maybe you'll talk to me again.
Okay. I would like to, you mentioned 43 in the attack upon, has there been any discussion about
the riot of 1943?
Yeah.
None yet.
I would like to, you know, because that was an incident in which I was deeply involved and was an important turning point in, you know, intellectually, I was convinced that, you know, that the evils of racism and its divisive character in terms of the working class, but, you know, you do, while you may intellectually overcome, it's hard to divest yourself totally of the virus, and, if you ever do, if you live in a white skin. But in 43, that event occurred in the attack upon the black community that began and, over the weekend. And Jeffries was mayor, and Pat Quinn was the head of the CIO council. And there was a great deal of concern upon the part of the labor leadership about this thing spreading into the plants